Welcome to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean.
And you're listening to New England's foremost addiction and mental health program.
So tonight, we got to get right to it.
Yes.
Tonight's theme is how the food industry chemically engineers food to make us crave it and even become addicted to it. And the importance, we're going to talk to someone else about the importance of healthy food choices and wellness in general as part of recovery. Our guests tonight are Michael Moss, author of Salt, Sugar, Fat. It's a great book. And Lisa Johnson, who's a health and fitness specialist. Michael joined us on the phone earlier. And we'll hear from Lisa later on in the show.
She's in the studio with us. And let's go to our interview with Michael Moss. Our interview today is with Michael Moss. Michael is an investigative reporter with the New York Times and a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. He's on the phone with us from New York to talk about his latest book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Right Turn Radio is a show about addiction, and the focus of today's program is about how we get hooked on certain kinds of foods, similar to how we get hooked on alcohol and drugs, and how the food industry engineers food to make us crave it. Welcome, Michael. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you so much.
Thank you for taking time out for us. The book is fantastic. What motivated you to take on such a big project?
Well, I was writing about jihadi militancy in the Middle East, if you really want to go back far enough, in 2008, when my editor here at the Times, Christine Kay, spotted an outbreak of salmonella in peanuts. By an American factory. It was sickening and killing people around the country. As I looked into that, it was clear that that was a story about the processed food industry losing control over its ingredients. And I then sort of segued and wrote about pathogens in hamburger. But in the course of writing about that, one of my best news sources in the processed food industry said to me, look, Michael, if you want to, you know, there's another public health crisis afoot that you really should look at, involving things that we, the processed food industry, intentionally put into our products and have absolute control over. He was mostly worried about salt, and that led me to look at sugar and fat as well, because together, you know, this is the holy trinity on which the $1 trillion processed food industry depends on for its profits and survival.
So your book says that the food industry has found a way, systematically a way, and you're very careful not to assign, you know, blame. These are people doing their job, which is to sell food to the American public. But you're saying that they found a way to get people to crave the food they make. What did you learn?
I also like to say that, you know, I don't view these companies as being these evil empires that intentionally set out to make us obese or otherwise ill. You know, the problem lies in their collective zeal, if you will, to do what companies do, which is to make as much product money as possible by selling as much product as possible. And they have learned by hiring food scientists, you know, and marketing experts how to make their products utterly irresistible. And I have to say that, you know, based on the documents and the interviews with top officials in the industry, the overwhelming thing that comes across is that they're getting us to not just like their products, but to want more and more of them. I was lucky to spend time with a legend in the industry, Howard Moskowitz, trained in high math and then experimental psychology at Harvard. He's helped create many of the icons in the grocery store today. He walked me through his recent creation of a new soda flavor for Dr. Pepper. And to get to, you know, a flavor that was guaranteed to be a hit, he started with no less than 61 separate formulations of sweetness, each one just sort of slightly different than the other, subjected those to some 3,000 consumer taste tests around the country, took all the data, threw it in his computer, did his high math regression analysis thing, and found what's called in the industry, and he helped coin the phrase, the bliss point for sweetness, which is that precise amount of sweetness that's guaranteed to send us over the moon, not too much, not too little. And actually, if you put our liking for sweetness on a bell-shaped curve, it looks like a bell-shaped curve that we used to you know, grade, you know, elementary school students on. And right at the top of the curve, though, is not a C, but it's the A-plus for, again, the perfect amount of sweetness.
That, what you're describing, Michael, is a little scary to me.
Well, you know, they call this, you know, and these are their words, too. They call this food engineering as much as they do sort of food invention. And that's a really insightful term, and so much about the lingo that the food industry uses is very revealing. Because, look, you have to remember, these companies are spending millions and millions of dollars in developing a new product. They don't want anything to go wrong. So hitting the precise amount of sweetness or fatness or saltiness in the food is really, really important to them and their potential profits.
The interesting thing to me is how sugar plays into a lot of these equations and you know, the role that sugar plays in getting people hooked on processed food. I've seen it with myself. How does that work? How do people get addicted to sugar, and what role does sugar play?
Well, one of the things that's happened over the years is that the food industry, knowing that we love sweetness and that kids especially are hardwired for sweetness, every one of our 10,000 taste buds are wired for the sweet taste. They'll send an electronic signal to the pleasure center of the brain that tells you to eat more. Remember those old you know, maps of the tongue that used to be taught in school, that just like the tip of your tongue was
right
there?
Right.
Well, it's not true. It's an exaggeration. You might taste sweetness a little bit more on the tip of your tongue, but every one of your taste buds, and going all the way down to your gut, have taste receptors for sweetness in them. But what's happened, you know, in the past decade or two, as the obesity crisis grew and grew, was that the companies realized that they could engineer bliss points for products all over the grocery store. And so sweetness became something you just wouldn't experience in the dessert aisle or with the cookies or the soda aisle. Suddenly breads were given sugar with a formulated bliss point for sweetness. You know, low-fat yogurts can have as much sugar in them as ice cream. I was startled by the pasta sauce aisle, where some of the commercial brands can have the equivalent of a couple of Oreo cookies in a tiny half-cup serving. And so, in the words of a food scientist who works for the industry, you know, the companies learned how to exploit the biology of the child in teaching them to expect sweetness in everything they eat. So when you take that child, or my 9-year-old and 13-year-old in my case, and try to get them to eat broccoli or zucchini, mushrooms, the fruits and vegetables that they should be eating more of, it becomes a much harder sell because they're picking up on bitter notes instead of sweetness.
Right, and so what you need to do is dip it in maple syrup, and it'll be fine.
So that was Michael Moss discussing fat, sugar, mostly sugar in that part. Really nice interview, John.
Thank you.
And we have Lisa Johnson, a health and fitness expert, in with us today. And Lisa, is this something, I mean, we get this kind of information all the time. How do you talk to clients about this kind of thing?
Oh, sure. It's, hello, everybody.
Hello, Lisa.
This is one of the main topics of discussion with my clients, is their sugar addictions, is what they call it. They'll even talk about going through sugar withdrawals. Yeah, if you decide to, you know, all right, I'm going to the grocery store, I'm buying lettuce.
Right.
You know, they come in on Monday morning with their salad, and then by Tuesday they're ready to kill somebody because they're going through sugar withdrawals. And, I mean, I've done it myself. I was sort of surprised. And then the other thing that most people don't realize is white bread and white processed flour is essentially sugar. And they think it's a little better than sugar, but it's really just the same thing. Your body processes it the same way at the same speed.
What's wrong with having too much sugar?
It will do things like Michael Moss talked about. It will skew your taste buds to prefer ever sweeter things. Eating food that has a little bit of bitterness to it is actually good for your digestive system. You want to have a little bit of bitter in your day, once or twice a day. And most people, that doesn't even occur to them.
Well, I was reading that there's this whole thing about people liking more sour because they're liking this Greek yogurt. But
yeah.
Greek yogurt, you have to put 4 teaspoons of sugar in
right.
to make it sweet instead of 2. So it's this brilliant marketing thing. I'm like, Wow.
Is it a cultural thing with the United States more, or Western culture more, that we skew towards sugar? We use a huge amount compared to others?
I think, kind of going back to Michael Moss's point with food engineering, that it's what we've been trained mm-hmm. to like. It is what the food industry gave us, and we took it hook, line, and sinker. Didn't occur to us that they were potentially damaging our bodies. And you're seeing all kinds of increases in digestive issues, Crohn's disease, diabetes, heart disease. I mean, this is all directly related from the food that we eat.
It's a great topic. We'll be back in a minute. Here's more from my interview with Michael Moss, author of Salt, Sugar, Fat. What's interesting about what we're talking about, and we are a show that deals with addiction and recovery and mental health issues, is that I could, you know, insert the word, opiate for sugar, or some of the alcohol for some of these things, and it would be the same mechanism in the brain. It would be the same, many ways, marketing system as well. So it's hard not to listen to you and feel that there's some kind of insidious work being done behind the scenes. So when I go into the store and buy a bag of Cheetos, I think I'm getting a bag of these, you know, very brightly colored puffs of whatever they are. And you tell us in the book that it's a lot more than that.
And in fact, you mentioned Cheetos. It's a lot more than even salt, sugar, fat. One of my favorite terms that the food industry uses to describe the engineered allure in its products is something called vanishing caloric density. And it's that phenomena when you put a crisp puff like a Cheetos into your mouth and press it with your tongue, it melts. And when it melts, that sends a signal to your brain that it's basically disappeared along with whatever calories might have been in there. And that then, that then tells the brain to basically send a message back to you. Hey, Michael, love that, you know, cheese puff thing. Eat as much as you want. I don't have to put the brakes on you. Vanishing caloric density. Yeah, again, you know, the key to understanding the food industry, whether you're a consumer or investor, is knowing that they are driving as hard as they can to make their products irresistible and doing everything they can in that regard.
Is there an analog between the tobacco industry and the food industry in the way
some really surprising ones. Philip Morris, the largest tobacco company in the world, became the largest processed food manufacturer in the world. Most people have sort of forgotten this.
Wow.
Back in the 80s, when it bought the old giant General Foods and then Kraft. And for the first two decades, through the 80s and 90s, you can see through the documents that I got a hold of, you know, the tobacco executive doing what you would expect them to do, sort of pushing and cajoling their food division people to sell as much product as they could, and in some cases lending them some of their marketing schemes to help the food division people, schemes that worked for tobacco. But then starting in the 90s, Philip Morris got religion on government intervention. They became the first tobacco company to accept government regulation, and when they basically as a means of staving off complete disaster. They were polling, and they were worried about losing the entire public trust over tobacco. But when they did that, they turned to their food division people and said, hey, you guys, you know, are going to face as great, if not a greater, problem over salt, sugar, fat, obesity as we are now over nicotine and tobacco, and you've got to do something to lessen your dependency. This was back in 1999. That was just sort of an incredible moment of sort of self-enlightenment and awareness, certainly within the food industry itself, that it was running into a bigger and bigger problem of public trust over its products.
I mean, that's a little shocking to me. You mentioned dependency on these foods, and again, there's the analog between the, you know, drugs and alcohol, tobacco, and the food industry, and you talk about in the book about how the soda industry, the beverage industry, talks about heavy users.
Yeah.
I mean, is this, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I want to understand this better. Talk me out of the belief that I think the food industry is like a drug dealer.
You know, I have, well, let's go back to the A word for a moment, addiction. I actually use that word rather sparingly in the book because the food industry will argue that food addictions differ from narcotics addictions in lacking some of the technical thresholds that you might find in narcotics addiction. And I was sort of sympathetic to that viewpoint until I met Nora Volkow, who is the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse.
Yes.
She's an incredible neuroscientist who started out studying, you know, how the brain responds to narcotics, but then she started looking at how the brain responds to food and explaining to me that narcotics, in fact, follow the same neurological pathways from the blood system or the tongue to the pleasure center of the brain, sending those signals, those overpowering signals. And she said to me, look, Michael, you know, for many, many people, the most highly sweet, highly fatty foods will every bit drive patterns of compulsive intake as some narcotics will. And in fact, you know, dealing with a food addiction or a food hook or whatever you want to use the word is even harder than dealing with narcotics because food isn't, you just can't go cold turkey and stop eating or drinking. And also the marketing is in your face everywhere you look. You know, narcotics are generally hidden and you have to go find your dealer someplace to get your supply. But you walk down the street, you turn on the TV, and there is advertising for some people, it's some of the most treacherous foods and drinks right there in your face.
Why do we like this stuff? What evolutionarily, what's in it for us to have salt, sugar, and fat?
You know, there is, first of all, the formulation, which, again, is engineered to sort of maximize the appeal. And the most perfect products are those that have salt, sugar, and fat, all three of them in. And I love to talk about potato chips, one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah.
We all know they're salty, and that's usually right on the surface of things. It's the first thing to hit your taste buds. It provides what the industry calls flavor burst. They're soaked in fat, which provides what the industry calls the mouthfeel of fatness, which is that sensation of biting into a warm, gooey, toasted cheese sandwich. And I can just say those words and think about it. My brain is already lighting up. You can tell I'm a real salt and fat guy as much as sugar. But what I didn't know is that potato chips are loaded with sugar, not added to the chips, but in the form of the simple potato starch,
right,
which gets converted into glucose starting the instant it hits your tongue. So that is, that's part of the game right there. You also have to remember is that the marketing of these products is really intense. I mean, they have geniuses at work finding ad campaigns, packaging, displays, cartoon characters, everything to sort of exploit our weakest moments and or appeals. I talk about the creation of the Lunchables, which is this TV dinner type tray that was invented for kids to sell. Initially, it was to sell bologna and cheese and crackers to kids who otherwise might not be eating that. And it was basically a marketing success and was sold to kids, you know, under the rubric of all day you got to do what they say, but lunchtime is all yours. It was sold as sort of an empowering thing.
Mm.
And the package itself was conceived as like a gift wrapping that moms or dads who are working outside of the home could give to their kids as almost to ease their guilt a bit as they go off to the office and can't spend the day with the kids. So it's part formulation, and it's a large part marketing. And then there's one other thing that happened, which was back in the 80s, almost overnight, it became socially acceptable to eat anything, anywhere, anytime. And when an obesity expert sort of told me this, it really sort of turned on a light bulb because that played right into the hands of the processed food industry. They started making more snackable foods, more food you could eat with one hand while doing something else, which led to this phenomenon of sort of mindless eating where you're eating but you're not paying attention to the food. And that's when the formulas and the marketing can really take over then and eliminate the body's sort of natural brakes on overeating. And all of what you hear about today in terms of fighting back and regaining control over your appetites and your diet really have to do with turning what's become mindless eating into more mindful eating.
So I love that, mindful eating. So we're in the studio listening to this, talking about the marketing of food, and a couple of moms in here have some good stories. And Lisa, you were talking about being with your child.
I let my son watch educational television when he was really little, and one of the sponsors was McDonald's. And they never talked about the brand. It was Ronald McDonald running across the screen being happy, and you just see the golden arches at the end. That's all it ever was. And he was 18 months old. I was in his stroller, and we walked by a McDonald's, and he turned around, and he looked at me, and he went, ba-da-ba-ba-ba. I was so mad.
Yes, we all have those stories. The big M, we call it in our family, because before you could read, that was what he said. Can we go the big M?
Really?
Yeah.
It can be kind of insidious. And just so, like, you know, that ba-da-ba-ba-ba, which we're just giving him free advertising. But to hear that makes people, it can make people like, I need some French fries.
I'm kind of hungry.
I need some French fries right now.
We'll be talking about how to stop the cycle of food cravings right after the break.
And we're speaking with Michael Moss, author of Salt, Sugar, and Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. And in the studio, we have Lisa Johnson, a health and fitness expert here in the Boston area.
and I really love this interview because it the parallels between the conscious addicting of children and grown-ups to sugar reminds me so much of, here, you want to try this first one? These first few are going to be free, and
right,
you'll really like them. You know, these tablets here, they'll make your day.
And coming off of it, you know, we're talking with Lisa and you know, coming off of, people scale off some of these things, and he talks a little about that coming up in the interview, but it's kind of the same way that some people get off drugs.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the parallels are really useful.
So let's go back to our interview with Michael Moss. How can we stop the cravings for, you know, the cycle of cravings for salt, sugar, and fat? Is it as simple as going cold turkey?
You know, Michael Pollan has a great book out called Cooked right now, where he's arguing that just spending a little time in the kitchen, sort of chipping away at some of the processed foods you used to buy and eat, and cooking them yourself, can really go a long way toward, surprisingly, curbing your appetite. He believes strongly that when you cook food yourself, you're actually going to eat less than you otherwise would. So for those people who can find time to do some cooking, and it doesn't take as much time as you might think, you don't have to cook professionally to cook really well and healthfully and peacefully.
Right.
I've been working on pasta sauces myself, and they're so easy to do yourself. Convenience is I think, a bit overblown when it comes to processed foods. The other thing is just kind of shop smarter. And you have to realize when you walk in the door of the grocery store, the manufacturers and the retailers doing everything they can to get you to make a spontaneous decision. So, you know, you make a list, you find those products that are healthier, you make a list and you stick to those. And to find the products that are healthier, one of the real truisms now is that you look high, or you reach high, or you look low, because the items that are most heavily sugared and fatty and salty are placed at eye level in the grocery store.
Wow.
Because they know through research that's where you look when you walk into the aisle. And so if you want cereal that has less sugar in it, look on the ground floor shelf or reach up high. And it's there if you work at it and find it.
Our co-host Abby says just stay on the outside aisles of a supermarket.
Yeah, that's another good one, because that's typically where the fresh fruits and vegetables are placed, or the less processed meats or dairy. The things that we should, especially the fruits and vegetables we should be eating more of, tend to be on the periphery of the aisle, and the more ultra heavily processed foods are in the center or at the checkout counter,
right,
where one of the most, you know, lucrative pieces of the real estate in the grocery store for the companies.
To check out. Why does this impact lower income people more than higher income people?
I think because they're struggling with life generally. There's sort of more stress that can lead to compulsive eating, rather. It costs more to eat healthy. Even when you walk in the door knowing to spend time in the periphery to buy healthier items and fruits and vegetables, it's going to cost you because of the sort of upside-down agribusiness economic policies in this country. So that's yet another reason.
So you talked about making your own pasta sauce and things like that. What other food choices have you made once you learned what you learned?
I'm trying to reclaim pizza as a healthy food. I mean, I happen to think that it's been hijacked especially by the fast food industry, but frozen pizza as well. It does not have to be unhealthy, and it doesn't have to take time either. And so I've been experimenting with doughs where you spend, 3 minutes kneading the dough, and you can throw in a bunch of whole wheat flour too when you're making it yourself. Put it in the fridge, take it out in the morning. At about 6 p.m., I'm still at work, and I call one of my kids and say, hey, crank up the oven. I'm going to be home in 45 minutes. It's super hot. I did buy a pizza stone, which will make the crust incredibly crispy and lovely. And then I make a sauce by just opening a can of whole tomatoes, draining off the juice and chopping it up, and just put that on the pizza. And then you can add whatever it is you want. Some cheese, some vegetables. You can coax the kids into eating lots of stuff on pizza that they wouldn't otherwise. And in half an hour, be done with it. So that's one of my favorite things lately, is to basically reclaim what became a junk food and turn it into something healthy. I just love that idea.
Is this trend that we see in the United States now of foodies and kind of locally sourced food, is that going to be co-opted by the food industry?
I definitely think we're at a tipping point now where more and more people are caring about what they're putting in their bodies. Going down the road, I see the food giants responding to that concern by offering quote-unquote healthier versions of their products. It will be seen whether people actually buy those products in mass. The industry is always, one of its defenses has always been, we offer people a choice. If they want low-fat, low-sugar, it's there in the store somewhere. They can buy it while they're selling their mainline product, at full speed. Whether they truly can turn around and make deeply healthful versions of their products or not remains to be seen. I do know that many of these scientists I meet and interview in the book have come to have regrets about what they did and are just itching to go back to work to design truly healthful products that can be convenient and low cost as well.
Michael, what a great book and what a great service to the American public it is, because it's really opening our eyes. There's a lot more information coming out as time goes on. We really appreciate your help with this and helping us understanding this issue a little better. And it's really at the kind of the vanguard of a big, potentially very large health crisis that's coming up in this country. And we're interested in the way that it ties in with addiction and that kind of thing. So thank you so much for your taking time out today. This is Michael Moss, author of the new book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. He's a writer, an investigative reporter at the New York Times, and a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. Thank you so much, Michael.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Take care.
John, great interview. I'd like to point out that the parallels to addiction are amazing.
Oh,
he used
God.
The word mainlining. When they talk about their people drink a lot of soda, they're called heavy users. It's just like, but let's not be cynical.
But Lisa, how do you know, how will I know if I have a sugar addiction, and what can I do about it? How do you deal with that?
Don't eat sugar for a day and wait for the crushing, crushing headache to come and bring you down. It's pretty fast.
Yeah. You sound like you know what you're talking about.
Yes, been there, done that.
So, no, I mean, I think that seriously is something that's really important. You know, how do you know? And what do you do about it?
You know, there definitely has been discussion about sort of the symptoms of addiction for food. And people will, there was sort of this threshold that they were talking about in the interview is when does an addiction count when it comes to food? And you can't truly be addicted to food because it's how we live.
Right.
So there's some of those arguments there. But I think anybody who has decided to stop drinking coffee or, you know, decided to do maybe a juice fast, you're going to get those kinds of, your body will respond. There are low levels of withdrawal that do happen. They're real. You feel like crap. You have headaches. There might be things going on in the bathroom that you might not be happy about. You know, those are real. They happen.
Well, one of the things I've talked to my kids about is not having sugar for breakfast. And they're like, why? I said, watch this. And we will have a sugar breakfast and, you know, one of those great cereals.
Right.
And then they'll be like, oh, yeah, I really wanted sugar all day. And it's just like, it's really, you really have to educate us.
You know, you start becoming aware of this stuff and you realize how hard it is to stay on top of it and live a lifestyle where you can have, you know, if you're a busy person, have healthy foods, try to squeeze as much out of like a nutrition out of something as you possibly can and still eat so it's not going to kill you or you're not going to get addicted to fat, sugar, and salt. Like you have a food blog, Lisa. What advice do you give people?
Yes, our food blog is truefoodmovement.com, and we talk about this all the time. And doing a hardcore shift, I don't know, if you've got a couple hundred friends on Facebook, once a week somebody's saying, that's it, I'm going on the wagon, and they come back with their haul from the local grocery store with all the veggies, and then, you know, 3 days later, they're not talking about being on the diet anymore. It just kind of goes away. So my recommendation is just to start with little changes and do little things first. So a little protein at breakfast, for instance, will help curb sugar cravings. Having a little extra water in the day. Most people are thirsty when they think they're hungry.
This is great. I mean, can you really give up? Can an American person give up processed foods? I mean, is it possible?
I haven't eaten anything out of a box in about 6 months. So,
really?
Yeah.
She's so cool.
But it took me probably 10 years of slow evolution to get here. And it honestly started when my son started eating at the table. I needed to start making smart decisions.
Well, yeah, I mean, and trying to get kids to eat healthily is so hard. I remember introducing my son. My son came home, Mom, I want Lunchables. And we went out and we got him Lunchables, and he hated the flavor. It's just they came with a Snickers bar. He wanted candy for lunch.
Oh, it's like getting the Captain Crunch when you're a kid. You wanted to get the thing inside. Thank you so much, Lisa, for your help on the show today. Lisa Johnson, a health expert and fitness model.
We'll come back after next fitness model. She does have a show.
I actually have.
And we have another segment coming up.
We have another segment.
John,
I was getting
the
wrap
show.
Up. I thought I'm ready to go.
John,
processed food. I need some processed food.
So we will. Thank you. You're listening to Right Turn Radio.
Abby, we're back.
This is
a special bonus.
It's the encore
segment. This is the encore. The show is done.
So, and John, what happened there?
I lost my train of thought. I was a little confused looking at the script and mesmerized.
Could it be from lack of food?
I haven't eaten today.
That's right, because you.
I had a little dental stuff going on, and I haven't been able to eat too well.
So, Lisa. When people, I mean, what are some of the things that happen to people when they don't take care of themselves, and how do you teach them to balance? John, this is for you.
Brain fog is real. It does exist. energy levels are definitely something that you're going to see fluctuate throughout the day if you're not eating properly.
How about grumpiness levels?
Grumpiness levels.
Oh, yeah. Do you guys know the phrase hangry, hungry, angry?
Ooh,
I like that.
Angry.
Yeah.
I think that's a kid word.
Yes.
So how do you, I mean, one of the things we try to get people to do when they're getting sober or when they're giving up, you know, their addiction to anything is to balance. How do you teach people how to balance things?
Right. So like the idea of making a breakfast from scratch every day might sound like it's never going to happen. But for instance, what I do is I tend to eat eggs every morning. So I did it today. I made eggs with onions diced up, and I made enough that I've got 2 days worth in the fridge. So Monday and Tuesday are busy days for me. I start with my clients at 7 a.m. I take a batch, I throw it on a plate, it goes in the microwave for 30 seconds. I have a healthy breakfast. It's warm, it's got a good balance of protein and carbohydrates and fat. It took me 30 seconds. I'm out the door.
So we're all going over to Lisa's house for breakfast.
Thank you, Lisa. No, and so you try to give people little tips that can start changing their lives.
Yes, yeah. When you start talking about foods and eating more fruits and vegetables, you start looking at the prices between organic and regular
right.
food.
Yep.
And you don't have to go whole hog organic, at least not initially. What you want to do is if you do a web search for the Dirty Dozen fruits and vegetables, you'll get a list. It's from the CSPI, Consumer Something for Public Interest. And they update it every year. They research it all the time. And there's, generally speaking, fruits and vegetables with thicker skins. You don't need to buy organic. Like, I don't bother with onions or oranges or bananas. They have thick skins. You cut it off, you don't use it. So I just buy those at the nice, less expensive rate. But then there's things with thinner skins like blueberries, blackberries, bell peppers. Those are items that you really want to be able to buy organic if you can afford it.
But what do you do with all these people like John who likes salt, sugar, fat?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, my son for breakfast, if he could, he'd have Doritos. We have low-fat
really?
Versions of things that he has, but he would have a salty thing for breakfast every morning.
But in balance, salt, sugar, and fat is okay, correct?
Sure, right. I mean, if you cook at home, right. Like, yeah, you need salt or you die. So, you know, you got to have that. but what you would cook at home, even if you made brownies at home, you're not going to put as much sugar in it as a processed brownie is going to have.
Right.
And you're not going to put high fructose corn syrup in it, which is this very thick, glutinous stuff. You're going to put real sugar in it, which is a little bit healthier. So not, you know, super healthy, but a little better.
Okay, brownies are good for us. Let's go home and bake.
I heard her say on the radio, brownies are good for me. But it gets to that convenience thing and all that. I was saying that, you know, it's so easy to make your own pasta sauce and so simple. And everybody's like, yeah, but why? You know, it's like I can go to the store, but there's all that added stuff in pasta sauce.
Yeah, and so pasta sauce, super easy. Take a can of diced tomatoes or stewed tomatoes or crushed tomatoes, whichever one you want. And then I take a bag of frozen mixed vegetables, put the veggies in the pan, heat them up, dump the tomatoes on top, cook your pasta, boom, you're done.
Mm.
So, I get emails from you. We know each other outside of the studio. But you take on the food industry yourself. Do you really think the public can do something to, like, change this whole fat, sugar?
I actually agree with Michael Moss, and I would say with Michael Pollan as well, that I think that we're coming to a tipping point. I think we're pretty close to it. There was a 4 million people voted to support genetically modified labeled foods, which was a big deal in California. The referendum lost, but 4 million people voted for it. As a result, there's been, you know, legislature all across the country supporting it. So we're learning slowly but surely that the food industry doesn't have our best interests at heart, and that we do need to be more proactive.
And I liked how he said didn't think they were evil. Their goal was just to make money. But then he did realize that it was manipulating addiction levels.
You have to perpetuate the, you know, the comeback. As
well,
they
you have
say.
To have more. I mean, more
right.
and more and more. And that's why everybody's getting heavy.
And so, you know, part of the take home with this is, you know, the buyer beware until it becomes really financially rewarding for the industry to become healthy and kind of skew towards that. We have to become better educated.
So have you heard of the phrase greenwashing?
No.
So greenwashing is an industry term, and it's talking about taking foods that aren't necessarily healthy, but making them look healthy. So if you see all natural or natural, that's not regulated in any way by the government. It means nothing.
Really?
If the box is green, there have been extensive studies done that people think if the box is green, it's healthier.
So I shouldn't have bought those green box brownies on my
Yes.
Well, so I think we need to admit that that sugar addiction is an addiction. It's being manipulated by people.
Yeah. And you know, you guys have kids, you can educate the kids to look, Abby, you were saying that they look at the label.
Yeah.
They
learned how to read them this year in second grade.
It's shocking to me that some of that stuff. I'm low blood sugar at you right now. Shocked, I tell you.
So Lisa, do you want to tell us a little about like how people can learn more about you?
Oh, yes. So I'm pretty easy to find. On Twitter, I am at Lisa Johnson. My fitness blog is lisajohnsonfitness.com, and our food blog is truefoodmovement.com.
She's got a really cool logo.
Can you?
Oh, you're really good at this. Is eating well affordable?
Yeah.
This is her thing.
We actually did a thing, it was about a year and a half ago now, where we ate near the poverty level for 30 days. There's three of us in my family. It was $491.10, and we only ate at Whole Foods, and it was every single meal. And it was like, can we actually do this? And we made a bet with Whole Foods, and we won. And they donated $500 to a local food bank. But the tomato sauce trick I picked up during that month. And
wow.
That was actually when I realized you didn't have to buy tomato sauce. It just never occurred to me that I could make my own. So it definitely can be done. You have to look for sales. You have to kind of be smart about how and when you buy organic.
And don't buy processed foods. They're expensive.
Yeah, if it's in a box, it costs more money. You're paying more money for them to help you stay addicted.
So thank you so much, Lisa Johnson. And we are on Facebook as Right Turn.
John, go eat some food.
I need some food.
That's healthy food.
You've been listening to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. Check us out at right-turn.org. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean. Remember, be safe and ask for help.